We're back with Clifton Collins Jr. Over the break, we were talking about Robert Easton, the late great dialect coach, and you worked with him.
I did. I don't recall how I even got in touch with him, but I'm like the kind of cat where I love to do my research, and if I come up with this idea or it's already pre-written into the script that there's an accent and it's a character, not just some silly character, but one that your heart and soul can like just breathe life into because you just want to do this. I would spend, you know, the $250 or whatever it was to sit down with this man. He was a badass. You know, he looked like Uncle Jesse from the Dukes of Hazzard, the TV show. Mm. He looked just like that. And he had all these books everywhere. But I had the beautiful joy of, I don't know why I didn't put this together, but it wasn't until I think I was doing an accent for, it might have been a Cockney accent. I mean, this guy could whip them all out. I mean, he did Forrest Whitaker's for the King of Scotland, mm-hmm. We realized that he had done the voiceover for The High and the Mighty, which was my grandfather's very first movie with John Wayne.
Wow.
So there's something really beautiful about being able to sit down with your family's peers of past, you know?
Yeah.
Something really special about that.
Yeah.
So I had a great time up sitting there and just working with him. We get our tape set up and just watching the man go. I mean, he was truly brilliant at it. Really yeah. Fascinating act. Like, you'd never know. I mean, overalls, a big white beard, and long white hair. It was like...
I understand he was a great storyteller as well.
Oh, absolutely. He had so many different actors that he would tell stories about. And he didn't know I was friends with Forrest. Towards the end, he was telling me about the King of Scotland stories when he'd call and just to get a checkup on his accent and mm-hmm. things of that nature. So... But prior to, I mean, and he was such a grandpa-y kind of guy. Like, he got really weak towards the end. He was like, well, you know, would you mind help me? I've got to move. I'm like, I'm on your goddamn lawn. Like, what do you need? Mm. You know, he'd grab big boxes, moving crates after I cut him a check for $250 or whatever it was. You know, cars were like, you know, low on air and his wife had passed and all this stuff. So I like my heart went out to him. But, you know, I got a lot of respect for, most of my elders that are good people, especially people in this business.
Yeah. I mean, that's great to hear that you actually, that's been something that's been important to you to work with dialect coaches when you needed it and to use that as a resource. What kind of advice would you give to actors in terms of having a relationship with a dialect coach?
I think they're very, very important. If you're serious about your craft, you know, if you're doing something that really matters to you, you definitely should do it. I mean, you know, I started with these great little, you know, those dialect tapes and things of that nature. It's great for just getting your feet wet.
Yeah.
But if you really want to get down, like the way you and I got down on this film, you know, you got to sit down and you got to have somebody who's got a trained ear. You know, you'd be amazed at how many actors really don't have a trained ear.
Mm.
Once again, you know, I grew up just listening to people. I like mimic. I can imitate people just in, you know, in just minutes of hanging out with them. And that's just a gift that I acknowledge and know that I have.
Mm-hmm.
It's just some shit I used to do to get away with shit all the time. And I realized it was actually a gift, which is really dope. But, you know, also for me personally, I love to, if I can get down to the environment early is clutch for me. Put me in an environment with those type of people that I think this character is. But prior to, if you don't have that kind of knack or capabilities or resources, man, get a good dialect coach on a Skype session or even on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you record it. You know, that tape I did with Marco Hofschneider, I still have the cassette tape.
Yeah.
You know, I've been very tempted to listen to it. And I'm gonna listen to it. It'd be fun. I'd like to brush up on that monologue.
Well, you actually threw down with it here, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. I'm a little embarrassed because I know how good it actually can be. But I keep all my dialect tapes, and you can use them, too, in the future, too, if you do a southern drawl or, you know, you do an occasion one in the bayou there, Sean. You there with all the Cajun, you need to get a tail. You know, there in the back room on the houseboat, you know, you know, the poodle on the back that they be brewing there. You know, it's like all that shit, like when I did Little Chenier, to me, Cajun at the time, for me, in my mind, creatively speaking, was probably the hardest accent I could ever fathom. And then I started hanging out with the people, and at first, it was something I just, like, what did you say? you know, and then suddenly, next thing you know, I'm just embracing it and being it and living it. And to the point where one of their reporters in town came and wanted to interview me. And I pretty much stayed wearing the same Cajun kind of clothes that I came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And the director claimed that that's not really how they dress and yada, yada. But then while we were shooting, I think everybody started to see that that was how they dressed. And somehow I just tapped into it. There's a thing you can tap into. I don't want to call it a psychic thing, but it's just knowing how to just fit in. And next thing you know, I'm like, any chance I had, like, you know, even my cast chair I got rid of. Like, oh, Mr. Collins, here's your cast chair. I'm like, what the hell am I cast chair for? I'm like playing a poor Cajun person.
Right.
You know, and what they lack in finances, they're insanely rich in culture and love and kinship and all these other things that you cannot buy with money. And I gravitated towards them. I said, you want to find me? I'm going to be in their houseboat. I'm going to be in that bar. You know, I'm going to be, you know, in that restaurant. I'm going to be wherever the Cajuns are. You'll find me with the people. Because we would often shoot, and we were shooting in Cameron Parish and Little Chenier. We were shooting in Big Chenier and all the bayous. Actually, the last known footage prior to Hurricane Rita.
Mm.
On film, this is like literally like 2 weeks. This is the last known footage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those kind of things for me are very, very important. Not to mention you pick up the nuances of the people as well if you want to make some great character choices. Like if I had the opportunity to play that role in Saving Private Ryan, obviously I'd have to watch documentary footage and just see how they even move, you know? Because it's old world.
Yes, yes. What can you say about the kind of movies that, do you think that the kind of movies that we're making nowadays are helping people learn more about different cultures and getting inside of cultures better than they have in the past?
That's a really interesting question. You know, you have directors like the director we're working with now, John Hillcoat, that understands what's going on here in America. I mean, you have a lot of Mexicans here in Atlanta. You know, when I came here 10 years ago, I didn't see this many Mexicans. I'm just quite surprised to order my room service and I can actually talk Spanish to them. You know, so you know, Hollywood is very much of a formula. This is the movie that made money this way, so we'll do it again and again and again. Even breaking the realities of what is, you know, it's so easy for them to say, oh, everybody in the South, Southern, and this is how they are. But, you know, John Hillcoat's thinking, he's actually not thinking out of the box, truth told. He's thinking out of the Hollywood box. But
right.
But conversely, he's thinking in the box of reality, which is where I get off. I love this shit. I love the real shit. I love the fact that John is just that kind of a director. We're very fortunate because this could have been a different type of film. You know, all due respect to those more commercial, you know, company men, this would have been a, you know, an insanely lit film with very cliched characters and things that just sell, you know, and the kids buy it. You know, it might not have been real, you know, and granted it's a movie, so there's a level where we can play with the realities and stretch the truths, but Hollywood likes to stretch them like a Stretch Armstrong doll. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Dialects
are always changing.
Yeah.
And you've talked about a lot of the ways that you negotiated between different groups and speaking with different styles. How do you observe, you're living out in Los Angeles now.
Yes, sir.
And how do you observe dialects changing just as we move into the 21st century?
Man, it's really interesting. I don't think I'm a good gauge for that because I live in Studio City now.
Right.
So it's just about as white bread as you can get. You know what I mean? I like it. It's peaceful. Mm. I don't have to walk around my heater anymore, which is real nice. You know, I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore. I don't have to worry about graffiti or none of that. And look, I love good graffiti. Mr. Cartoon is one of my dearest friends, you know, but that's an art form. It's a little different. But I don't got to worry about youngsters or any of this other stuff. On the same note, now I love to go to, you know, YA or Homeboy Industries and help out over there. You know, always remember where you come from. But I noticed the accents there. The accents are very, very different. They're still very Chicano, very Latino. And depending what kind of Latino neighborhood it is, it could be Latino black. It could be, a mixture of so many different things. There's so much raza here in America. There's so many Latino cultures here now, all across it, not just New York and California. They're all over now. So it's changing. So, you know, there's going to be, next year, they're going to be serving salsa at Cracker Barrel and Applebee's next.
What do you think about the characterizations that we're now seeing on television and just more Latino faces and sounds and characters?
You know, my grandpa used to say this, money erases all racism. And when you have this many Latinos in America, you know, maybe even if we weren't, if there weren't Mexican mayors or Latino mayors or you know, Latino judges or cops, I believe Hollywood would still put them in there because there's too many of us.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, there was an organization created, you know, Ricardo Montalban created this organization called Nosotros that was striving for positive images in the Latino cinema culture. And I've got mixed feelings on this. I mean, once again, as I said earlier, like, why can Robert De Niro go and play what's alleged to be a stereotype, a derogatory character within his culture, yet I do it and I get slammed? You know, I do like 187, where people, you know, Warner Brothers was talking about, you know, for your Oscar consideration. You know, and I get slammed by my community. I don't understand that hypocrisy. You know, And I spoke to my grandfather. I said, you know, a big pause in his career came when Nosotros came into being because, you know, he shouldn't be playing the Bandido in the Fritos commercial. So they went black. They went with, like, natives. He lost a whole campaign. And that was a tough time in the 70s for my grandfather and my family struggling. And albeit when he was a contract player for Wayne, he was paid, like, fat and in full and took care of his whole family, extended cousins, you know, extended everything, you name it. You know, if friends were coming over, he'd always tell me, we feed your friends because we don't know when their next meal's coming. That's their mentality. And it's a beautiful thing that I practice today. My friends come over, you're not leaving hungry. I promise you. So I asked him, I said, Grandpa, I said, well, what's the deal? What happened? And he said, look, mijo, look, how am I not going to play the Bandido? I'm a cowboy, you know? I grew up around cowboys. Like, I can't do this? And also, if they had a judge role for me or a doctor role, how am I going to do that? Listen to my accent. I can't even say these words. My grandfather couldn't read or write English. In fact, there's this great book, Latinos in Hollywood, that alleged that my grandfather, Uncle Tom, did on the Groucho Marx show, which is the show that garnered him great fame, and pretty much it was kind of like the discovery moment, like the overnight moment that he'd been doing since he was 7 years old.
Right.
Which is why he couldn't read, much like Sammy Davis Jr., who also couldn't read. They were both entertaining from the age of seven. You know, Hollywood didn't care about putting the kids through school, and vaudeville didn't have any kind of schooling. So it was very different. He goes, even if I did get those doctor roles, I wouldn't be able to say these words. You know, but then on the flip side, you know, I mean, who's Ricardo Montalban to come and say, everyone should talk like this? I mean, what Mexicans you know? Like, maybe from Mexico City, but the majority, like, that's like the 1% that talk. He's a tall, handsome, Latino, strapping, you know, 6'2", you know, speaks like he's some, I don't know what the hell that accent is personally, because I know millions of Mexicans that do not sound like that. But my grandpa did lose some job, and that was a tough time. So today, yeah, I mean, they're everywhere. I mean, presidents, you know, West Wing, you know, Jimmy Smits has done a great. I mean, all the Latino actors are capable, and they're all here now. So me personally, I love the edgy, cool underdog roles, the outlaw roles, the gangster roles, the crooked cops, real people.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, you know, I could really talk to you all day about this. I really appreciate you coming by and sharing your insights and throwing down some different languages here at Dialect Coach's Corner. The one other question that I would like to ask you is, what advice would you give to a young actor who felt like they might not have the kind of control over the way that they spoke that they would want?
Get a bomb-ass dialect coach, period. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. If you got questions, you've got doubts, the only thing that's going to give you confidence is preparation. Prep, prep, prep. that will make you confident. When you're confident, you come in and do whatever you want, however you want to do it. You know, there's nothing like, hey, football team's got coaches, basketball team's got coaches. You know, how's boxers got coaches. Look at Mike Tyson and the great coach he had and what happened when he was gone. You know, case in point.
I want to thank Clifton Collins Jr. for coming by Dialect Coach's Corner and throwing down some heavy-duty knowledge for all of us out there. Thank you, Clifton. We got to have you come back and talk about a whole bunch of other things that we didn't get a chance to touch on today. I really appreciate you coming by and talking to us all today.
Yeah, that'd be a blast. I'd love to, man. Thanks for having me.
And if we had a studio audience, they'd be on their feet right now putting their hands together for Clifton Collins Jr. Thank you for tuning in and listening to the podcast, Dialect Coach's Corner. I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach. And remember, in the immortal words of my mother, Sue Willie Butler, make your life about something. Don't use your head for nothing but a hat rack.